Well, I wanted to start with a quote from popular culture, or at least something that I think is popular culture. I'm not really sure what popular culture actually is, so it's more I'm just starting with a random quote and trying to pass it off with greater significance than it actually has. So for anybody who can just say where this quote is from, you get 20 points in... yeah, good question, actually. There's only two kinds of straight people in the world. The ones who hate you to your face and the ones who hate you behind your back. Anybody know? Yes, that's quite correct. It comes... I'm going to tell you. God. I like sort of participation in sections, but give me a second. It's spoken by Brian Quinney. Brian Kinney. He's a character in the television show Queer as Folk, the American version. He said that in the second episode of the series. And I wanted to start with that, not just because, much to my shame, Brian Kinney remains my favourite character from that show, but because I actually think that in just a simple quote like this, a whole bunch of the ideas which are inherent to identity politics are really represented. And I think it sort of shows that identity politics have had a massive and at times subliminal effect upon popular culture, or random culture as I'm now going to term it, and has been fashionable on the political left for the past quarter of a century. So this talk obviously is going to go through a number of the major concepts and theories behind identity politics, and also it's going to offer a number of sort of like general comments on where it actually came from and how it rose to prominence. But it's also going to be an unrestrained critique of these ideas, which is going to argue that basically for humanity to ever achieve sexual liberation, we need to defeat the ideas of identity politics. They need to be gotten rid of entirely and to be replaced with the Marxist conception of sexual oppression and sexual liberation. So in terms of people who haven't come across identity politics too much before, the basic idea that underpins it is that only those who suffer from a particular form of oppression can understand that oppression, and only they have the right or responsibility to resist it. By implication, the enemy who is responsible for the existence of a form of oppression is basically everybody else who doesn't experience it themselves. And this is often perceived as being somewhat of an amorphous, backwards blob that inhabits society. Identity politics consciously rejects any idea that the working class can affect change when it comes to questions of oppression. And in fact, it usually perceives workers as being the enemy of liberation. And in the place of such class politics, it embraces a form of oppressed communalism, where the determining factor in a person's life is whether or not they experience a particular form of oppression and not their class position. And these politics do not, it's worth saying from the beginning, accidentally reject Marxist conceptions of social change, but rather they should be seen as a conscious attempt to attack socialist ideas and to overturn their key elements. So in terms of its origins, it develops within roughly the sort of like mid-1980s onwards. Similar understandings of oppression to identity politics had been expressed before this period, but this is the first time it presented itself as self-articulated identity politics proper, based as it was upon a lot of postmodern ideas and post-structuralist ideas. So germinations of these ideas can be seen in earlier movements of the oppressed. They tended to be amongst a political current that was more identified with bourgeois or capitalist sections of the movement, representing a section of society that found itself stifled by the denials of opportunity within their own social class, in the case of the ruling class, or within the social class that they aspired to join, in more middle-class elements that wanted to climb the ladder. And it was filled with absolute condescension, fear, and hatred towards the working-class sections of the oppressed. So just give one example of this, one isolated example. Christabel Pankhurst articulated politics that are actually strikingly similar, though not the same, as a lot of identity politics within the suffragette movement in Britain. In 1906, she wrote a pamphlet where she was basically arguing explicitly against the ideas of socialist and trade union women who were agitating for women's suffrage amongst a whole range of other demands of working class women and attempting to integrate the demands of women workers within the broader working class movement. And Christabel Pankhurst wrote, "Ours is not a class movement at all. We take in everybody, the highest and the lowest, the richest and the poorest. The bond is womanhood. The socialists are fighting against certain evils, which they believe to be attributable to the spirit of injustice as between man and man. I am not at all sure that women, if they had had their due influence from the beginning, would not have brought about a totally different state of affairs. It comes to this. The men must paddle their own canoe, and we must paddle ours." And similar sentiments, again, could be seen within the women's liberation movement of the late 1960s and the early 1970s, particularly in America. We had a situation where it was a real lack of class struggle due primarily to the existence of McCarthyism, the right-wing reaction there, and a long post-war economic boom, which made ideas that were focused upon working-class struggle far less attractive to a large number of the movement who were drawing themselves primarily from the middle class and who are reacting against the oppression that they experience from the capitalist system and the sexism of a great range of the men who were involved at that time on the far left. And a development in this period of patriarchy theory, a theory which is broadly generalisable to the idea that all men oppress all women, and that all women have the equal interest in uniting and fighting against that oppression. Again, this idea would later inform many of the theorists of identity politics. And these ideas that were first presented in the women's liberation movement, of patriarchy theory, etc., really spread around the world quite rapidly, engaging theorists in a whole range of the women's movements elsewhere in the developed world, as well as other movements such as the gay liberation movement. Now, due to both objective and subjective reasons, these movements, the more radical movements, began to decline alongside a more general decline in class struggle. And it was at this time that the key concepts behind patriarchy theory, and particularly the ideas of separatism that accompanied it, took hold. Particularly this idea that only those who suffer from a particular oppression can fight against it. The concept of a united revolutionary movement was utterly displaced at this point by an idea in which each oppressed group would form their own autonomous movement separate from the others. And this was really, again, a development that led directly into later identity politics ideas. But much of the theoretical underpinning of identity politics comes from postmodernism. Now, I find postmodernism exceptionally difficult to define because mostly postmodern theorists find it exceptionally difficult to define, and that's part of the point. Because it's a really eclectic, abstract set of ideas. So in terms of a definition, I'm going to borrow from Terry Eagleton, a Marxist, who said, defined it as rather, "The contemporary movement of thought, which rejects totalities, universal values, grand historical narratives, solid foundations to human existence, and the possibility of objective knowledge. Postmodernism is sceptical of truth, unity, and progress, opposes what it sees as elitism in culture, tends towards cultural relativism, and celebrates pluralism, discontinuity, and heterogeneity." And it developed alongside ideologies of the new right, which were arising at the time to justify neoliberalism, in a social period where the ruling class around the world was really on the offensive against the gains that the workers' movement had secured, and the working class movements around the world had largely been defeated. The progressive social movements that had existed in the 60s and 70s, which aimed at ripping down the capitalist system, discovered that they were unable to do so, as they did not actually have the social power to directly challenge the exploitation at the system's core, and they suffered a decline and fragmentation as it became more and more obvious that the left itself was on the wane. And it was in this context that postmodern ideas, focusing on language, on discourses and ideology, found an audience, particularly in a number of the former radicals who had taken up academic positions and similar sort of intellectual positions. Terry Eagleton again comments on the class basis of postmodernism. "As those who are privileged, they're privileged enough not to need to know, for whom there is nothing politically at stake in reasonably accurate cognition, who have little to lose by proclaiming the virtues of undecidability." And just to take one person out of many, I think Michel Foucault, I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce his name properly, but it's how I do it. I think his thought is indicative of much of postmodernism, particularly the ideas that there are no objective truths and that truth or reality, if they do exist, are questions of mere perception, since we cannot actually know reality, which itself is mediated through language. And his perception of power, for instance, was rooted not in material realities of a class system or even systems of concrete oppression, but rather is a far more abstract concept. And he describes it in his History of Sexuality, where he writes, "Power is everywhere, not because it embraces everything, but because it comes from everywhere. Power is not an institution, not a structure. The individual which power has constituted is at the same time its vehicle." So here power is not rooted in the social structure. So, for instance, it's not the power of the ruling class to exploit the working class. It's not the power of the state to protect capitalist relations through the use of the police force or the army. But rather, power is this abstract relation that exists within every personal interaction and expressed through just about any means. So, of course, you can see how I'm exerting this extraordinary amount of power over all of you by standing up, speaking, you're listening, and hopefully throughout the discussion period, a lot of you will be exerting power over me by doing likewise, but not from up here. You have to stay where you are, which, again, is the example of power. So the major theorists of identity politics made no bones about the similarly eclectic and uneasily definable nature of the broad current of their politics, which is an intellectual trend which I think very much mirrors postmodernism. So rather than going through all of the major contributors, I wanted to focus particularly on one work, which is produced by Ernesto Leclerc and Chantal Meurthe. Again, I apologise for my bad pronunciation, who wrote a work called Hegemony and Socialist Strategy Towards a Radical Democratic Politics. Now, this book, which was released in 1985, I think is significant because it is the first work of clearly articulated and identifiable identity politics. And many of its major contentions are either paralleled or repeated by all subsequent identity politics theorists. So to give you a bit of a sense on them, both Leclerc and Meurthe had been involved in the social movements of the 60s and 70s, and following the course of demoralisation that I outlined earlier, they subsequently retreated into the academy, becoming part of the social milieu that, as Eagleton described, became the basis for the formulation of postmodern ideas, and they both still work in some of the most elite universities in the world. And both had actually seen themselves as belonging to a strain of socialism at this period, and they identified themselves as being post-Marxist. Now, like the postmodernism of Foucault and others, their theory was developed and its starting point was at the absolute height of abstraction. In particular, they rejected materialism as a way to understand oppression. They began hegemony with an all-guns-blazing assault against the very concept of historical materialism, drawing upon the worst stereotypes of Marxist thought, informed largely by the philosophies of the Stalinist parties around the world. They contend that Marxist theory sees the outcome of social development as being predetermined from the very beginning. They argue, for Marxism, the development of the productive forces played a key role in the historical evolution towards socialism, given that the past development of the productive forces makes socialism possible and their future development makes socialism necessary. According to this view, if history has a sense and a rational substratum, it is due to the general law of development of the productive forces. Hence, the economy may be understood as a mechanism of society acting independently of human action. So this conception of Marxists arguing that socialism is an inevitable development dictated by economic forces which operate outside the realm of conscious human intervention is a caricature of Marxism, which I said is influenced by a lot of the determinist, quite mechanical portrayals which are propagated by Stalinism and the big communist parties around the world, which had great intellectual influence for a period of time, which was falsely understood by many to be the genuine Marxist tradition, something that we in Socialist Alternative reject. Further from this, Leclerc and Meurthe's ideas and their theories are absolutely idealist and they're classless, which means that they don't locate oppression in the context of a class system where the capitalist class have an interest in the propagation and the maintenance of forms of oppression that actually bolster their ability to exploit the working class. And nor do they believe that the working class itself has either the ability or the interest in fundamentally challenging and eradicating oppression as part of a struggle for its own emancipation. And this, I think, means that while they may describe themselves as post-Marxist, the reality of their thought is that they're anti-Marxist. They argued that in the context of defeat of revolutionary movements all across the world, that the entire basis of socialist thought had to be reimagined, and that the rise of new social movements was a signal that an era of universal discourse was at an end, and that this laid the foundations for the regeneration of the left on newly developed terms. The new basis they identified was upon identity-based social movements, which would confront a society that had no totality, but was rather made up of a multiplicity of distinct and independent structures, so including political, economic, social, ideological structures, which were all independent from each other. They argued that these new social movements, and they were new because they weren't based on class politics or the so-called old social movements, they argued that they could replace the working class that was itself disappearing, and they believed that the remaining elements of the working class were bought off and disinterested in creating social change. Without a unifying force for the different oppressed groupings, which was based on class politics, they argued that it was both necessary and actually desirable that each oppressed grouping in society formed its own autonomous movement, so totally independent from the others. And this principle of autonomy, or I think it's better to say separation, has since become the binding principle of identity politics. And it's a concept that goes hand in hand with their rejection of totality, or rather rejection of the idea that different oppressions actually have the same source, that they can actually be traced back to the same beginning point. Rather that they contend that the experience of all forms of oppression and all their causations are actually totally unique and separate in a society which is a field crisscrossed with antagonisms, requiring the autonomisation of the spheres of struggle. So not only are antagonisms and oppressions autonomous from one another, but there is no possible way to locate the primary source of oppression. So now, to give them their due, they do actually reference in their book, Hegemony and Social Strategy, they do reference the social class is actually a sphere of oppression, but for them it's conceived as merely one amongst many. It's adrift in its own autonomous realm, separate from all the others. It has absolutely nothing to do with them. And all of the systems of oppression that they conceive of have their subjects, so they have those who experience the oppression, but they also have totally unique sets of beneficiaries. So you have all men who benefit who benefit from the oppression of women. You have all straight people who benefit from queer oppression. You have all white people who benefit from racism, and so on and so on. And so they reject any unified concept of liberation. They write, "The possibility of a unified discourse of the left is erased. If the various subject positions and the diverse antagonisms and points of rupture constitute a diversity and not a diversification, it is clear they cannot be led back to a point from which they could all be embraced and explained by a single discourse." So oppression for them, cheers, has become an entirely subjective matter. And the only condition by which to judge whether or not a group is oppressed is whether or not they believe that they are. To experience oppression in their eyes, you only need to feel that you do. Now, I think this is a particularly reactionary thought as well, and became particularly reactionary. And just one example of many that you could give of this is, I think, the rise of Pauline Hanson in the late 1990s in Australia and her One Nation Party, which argued itself against what it conceived of as being an unfair recognition and alleged privileging of the Indigenous and immigrant identity in Australia, and aggressively campaigned for the recognition of the identity of its own supporters. You know, the obviously poor, downtrodden, oppressed, racist, white, middle class in Australia. So people who are hardly oppressed, but in the eyes of Luclu and Moof, as long as you can articulate this sort of sense, then you actually do suffer from oppression. And the flip side of this understanding is, in fact, the most stark experiences of systemic brutalisation don't necessarily constitute oppression in their eyes. Luclu and Moof go so far as to give an example about slavery and to say that slavery is not an oppression unless the slaves themselves articulate that oppression. Their ideas of autonomy and their rejection of any societal totality means that for them there is no connection whatsoever between the economic, political realms of society under capitalism. So they actually argue that the state itself is independent from the rest of society, that it has no underlying class basis. So this idea that divorces the state under capitalism from the role that it plays in aiding the exploitation of the capitalists is an idea which is actually shared with much of social democracy and reformism, the idea that it's just a totally autonomous thing that you can capture or influence. And they actually went so far as to even argue that, you know, this sort of idea about autonomy and that there's no totality, that the different branches of the state were totally separate and autonomous from one another. Now, I've heard of the idea that there's a separation of powers. But this concept that, for instance, the Senate, the House of Representatives and the government, what you call here this like Prime Minister and the governing party, that they're all totally separate from one another, that they have absolutely no connection, they have no common interest, seems to me to be quite absurd. And hopefully it seems that way to you. Because if this was accepted today and we actually took these ideas up, then just, you know, to raise one particularly concrete example, you know, which obviously relates to some of the activity that I do, then is who would the Equal Love campaign raise a demand of repeal the ban on same-sex marriage to if all these things are just totally, totally separate? Would we be raising it to the 60% of supposedly backward people who maintain our oppression, who 60% who actually do support equal rights for same-sex couples? And I think it is like quite clear that for LGBTI people in Australia today, there is a body which systemically upholds our oppression in this legal sense. And I very much don't think that the marriage registry, last time I checked, when people went to try and get marriage certificates in Australia, when they were banned from doing so, I've just got this feeling that the marriage registry wasn't acting totally independent and autonomous manner from, for instance, the government that put through the ban on same-sex marriage. You know, call me mad, but that's just not the way it seemed to happen. Now, the only conclusion, if you don't think the state is rooted in an oppressive power structure, but rather is this totally autonomous body, would be to think that either you can influence it from within, which many people tried to do and dismally failed, or else to just totally dismiss it entirely as something that needs to have demands placed upon it. More often than not, the result of this political thinking was to move away from the ideas of political mobilisation that would raise demands against the state, and rather it was a turn inwards, particularly to focus on the establishment of community groups which were based around the experience of a particular oppression, such as support groups and things like that, and to become ever more preoccupied not with social change, but with personal change, with interrogating your self-articulated identity and the dominant discourses that influence your life. And as it developed throughout the 1980s and the 1990s, the idea of autonomy and that all oppressed in society, all the oppressed have a common interest, became more and more blatantly classless. It became the accepted norm on much of the left to argue that everyone who experiences a form of oppression has a common interest with everybody else who does who experiences that oppression. And oppression here is, again, not considered to be material structures of society systemically discriminating against a section of society for the benefit of another section, but rather it is simply a matter of ideas, of attitudes, and of self-perceptions. And hostility to the white male power structure, as some conceived of it, that maintained this oppression. Well, on one level, this idea and, you know, sort of opposition to that is actually quite understandable, because it is true that white, straight men continue to dominate the public institutions that govern people's lives through politics, the business world, the media, what have you. And people do often experience oppression in their interpersonal relationships. So it can have, like, I don't know, sexist dad or homophobic classmates or whatever it may be. So it's sort of like one of those common sense ideas that this is where oppression plays out. But just like a number of the other common sense ideas that exist under capitalism, this idea actually does very little to challenge the true cause of the problem. McLuhan Muff, just like all the other identity theorists who drew on their work, see every single member of an oppressed community, irregardless of their class position, as natural allies. And even if they recognise that maybe some friction does exist within the oppressed groups, they've actually eroded any justifiable basis from which to argue that they are actually not natural allies. Within identity politics, and this is probably the take-home lesson of this entire talk, within identity politics, the class struggle is not the solution to oppression, and it is in fact considered to be the problem. The reality is, in society, that sexual oppression does in fact affect different classes in different ways. So sexism permeates throughout all of society, and ruling class women, for instance, are actually affected by sexism. So, for instance, in Australia, it's estimated that due to institutionalised sexism within the corporate world, that in terms of the, like, the directors of companies and this sort of thing, women make up only 8.3% of that section of society. And on top of this, there are, you know, gender stereotypes and all these sort of things which do affect ruling class women to a great extent. But the fact that they have the social position and the material resources unavailable to working class women mean that ruling class women are often able to alleviate, if not to totally negate, much of the major sort of questions of oppression that working class women face, such as things about paid maternity leave, publicly funded childcare, abortions, which are not only legal, but are also safe and they're free. And within the LGBTI community or the queer community, it's also true that the wealth and the privilege of better off queers means that they can, again, escape much of the day-to-day homophobia that working class LGBTI people have absolutely no freedom from whatsoever. But more fundamentally, not only do ruling class women and ruling class LGBTI people experience their oppression different to working class sections of those groups, but they actually benefit directly from the fact that that oppression exists. And I think that they benefit from it in a way that no working class person does, whether or not they be male, straight, white, what have you. And I think you can see this with women, and I think you can see this with LGBTI people. And a couple of examples of this, which I found recently, one was quite fortuitous because it happened just a couple of weeks ago, was one of the series of the senior gay Republicans in the United States, the self-identified homocons. I don't know if people have heard that quite horrid phrase before. But, you know, the Republican Party, LGBTI people within it, who are, you know, just as bitterly against their own community, so-called, as their straight peers are. And so just in March, as a matter of fact, there's a Californian a Republican senator, his name was Roy Ashburn, who was forced to out himself after being caught because he was drunk in a car outside a gay club. So the fact that he's had to closet his lifestyle and that his career is at stake because of his homophobia shows that obviously he does suffer homophobia to a certain extent. But the reality is that as a ruling class apparatchik, as somebody who benefits from the exploitation of the working class, he in fact has shown no kindness to other members of his supposed community, and no kindness to the working class more broadly, for that matter. Over his 14 years in office, Ashburn has voted against a number of measures for LGBTI rights. Of course, he is based in California, which says a lot. And he's voted against efforts to expand anti-discrimination laws. He's voted against efforts to include, to recognise out-of-state gay marriages. And last year, as a matter of fact, he actually opposed a bill that was put forward to establish a day of recognition for Harvey Milk. People know the gay activist who was murdered a while ago. And the group Equality California, it's an LGBTI lobby group in California, and it sort of creates a scorecard of different all the senators and the people and the all other politicians, basically, and it rates them from one onwards to sort of say how friendly they are to LGBTI people. And over the last few decades or so, they've consistently given Ashburn a zero, which shows just how virulent his attacks on his own community has been. I think a number of examples of this class divide and the interest of ruling class people was the Pacific Brands Textile and Clothing Factory, which shut down in early 2009 in Australia, in the process sacking 1,850 workers, the majority of whom were migrant women. Now, the CEO of Pacific Brands, Sue Morford, had at this time just been awarded, or basically awarded herself, her pay rise of 127%, which took her salary to $1.8 million. Now, not only did Morford make her profits and sustain her position from the day-to-day exploitation of the workforce that she oversaw, but when this wasn't enough, when the insatiable demand for profit demanded more, she, like countless capitalists before her, was more than happy to sack scores of workers from the low-paid jobs that they and their families relied upon so that she could pocket the profits. And this is because capitalism as a system is defined by the relationship between the rulers and the ruled. The ruling capitalist class and a minority section of society that control all of the wealth that is produced by the working class, the mass of the population who sell their ability to work or our ability to work for a wage. This exploitation, the fact that the working class is forced to cede a large bulk of the wealth that it creates to the parasitic capitalists, is where the lifeblood of the capitalist system, profits, come from. Because of the centrality of this exploitation, capitalism is riven with oppressions, including sexual oppression. They are constructed and propagated from the top of society to perform numerous functions that are aimed at maintaining the status quo. They are, you know, aimed at dividing and conquering the working class, to permeate whole swathes of it with feelings of helplessness and despair, to better prevent them from struggling against the capitalist rule, and to maintain many of the social formations that a capitalist see as necessary, such as the ideology of the nuclear family. Identifying the main cause of oppression as being the backwards attitudes in society that people hold, cheers, is, I think, actually a fundamentally reactionary way of viewing the world. It means that the identity politics theorists end up blaming the victims of the capitalist system, the working class, rather than the system itself and the exploitation at the system's core. It means that the enemy, the capitalist class, or at least sections of it, are actually excused and seen as being allies, whilst the working class is either written off entirely and not even conceived of, or is considered to be the enemy of the oppressed. And I think this is like even just insulting in its real historical sense, which goes against countless time and time again experiences of working class solidarity with movements of the oppressed, which have been gone over in some of the other sessions of Marxism 2010. Now, not only does the theorising of Luclu and Mouff discount this long history of solidarity and the objective interests of workers in ending the oppressions that restrict and divide us, it also ignores the basic, very basic fact that under capitalism, oppressions constantly overlap. And that separate struggles do not correlate to different forms of oppression. So, for instance, where does an Indigenous woman fit within a system where both all white people, including white women, and all men, including Indigenous men, are considered responsible for their oppression and are the enemy? The underlying logic of these ideas of autonomy are actually to put forward greater and greater amounts of fragmentation and disintegration of oppressed groups. And if this is your perspective, I think the reality is that the possibility for actual liberation is absolutely nil. Such fragmentation and this utter focus upon individual experiences, the articulation of oppression, I think does absolutely nothing, when you just leave it at that, to challenge the source of our oppression, which is the capitalist system. The focus upon individual experiences to the detriment of collective action, in fact, mirrors much of the capitalist ideology out there, which wants to individualise workers and to reduce us to competing with one another, not to collectively resist the rule of the capitalists. And the anti-structural, classless nature of identity politics means that they are utterly incapable of challenging the core of the capitalist system. And rather, I think they actually become not a challenge to oppression, but a conduit to try and cope with it. And this ability of, you know, coping mechanism may perhaps work and suit the lifestyles of middle-class queers and middle-class women, but actually does nothing for queer and women workers who cannot just imagine our oppression out of existence in the ivory towers of academia, but rather we are forced to confront it each and every day. Now, by the early 1990s, I think it became particularly clear for anybody who had any concern for changing the world and any concern for liberation that identity politics itself had reached a form of crisis. Many who had been taken in by its ideas and its concepts did begin to sort of search around for a way out of this and the real paralysis that had set in. And others, of course, continued to exist in blissful ignorance of what was going on, churning out indecipherable intellectual tracts that may as well have been written in, I don't know, ancient Phoenician or something like that, for all the appeal that they had to people and for all the good that they did. Now, the work of a couple of people, Helen Makosha and Jan Petman, who are writing in the self-identified feminist journal Hecate, I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce that again, in the early 1990s, I think is an example of some of the theorists who were beginning to recognise the limitations of identity politics and were trying to figure out a new route forward for the movements. They argued in the early 1990s against the developing trend due to identity politics, where categories or identities are apparently homogenised or universalised, so that you are either an immigrant or an aged person, or a person with a disability or a woman. It is as if you cannot have a complex identity. You are being asked to choose which oppression is primary in your life and in which organisation and to which organisation your loyalties will be given. So they clearly recognised the process of fragmentation which was going on, and they saw it as being a problem, which is of course a credit to them. They recognised a theoretical fragmenting, but also a rather practical one. Because the experience of this this period was the hostility towards newly identified privileged agents within the oppressed communities. And this led to a greater and greater splintering into different oppressed identity-based groups. So I'll just give a more like clear example of what that actually means. I think one example of this is the rather long acronym LGBTI. People obviously know that as a way to reference lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender and intersex people. And while it's not a perfect example in many ways, you can see here just like a trend towards splintering within an oppressed community towards more and more different groups that saw themselves as being totally separate to the others, even though they suffered a similar form of oppression. Thank you. The offered solution of Makisha and Petman is that the politics of resistance must go beyond the simple affirmation of the legitimacy of difference, to recognise that women are not divided by the categories of race, ethnicity, sexual preference, disability and so on, but by the consequences of these particular specific forms of domination and discrimination in particular societies. So they want to find a way to overcome the limitations of identity politics, but within their work, they're actually unable to argue in any concrete sense how this would be achieved and how to move beyond many of the concepts of identity politics, of how to put this into effect in the context in which they were operating. They merely add that there's a need to embrace a wider struggle against oppression in which we negotiate the meaning and practice of difference. And ultimately, they are unable of overcoming the key elements of identity politics, which that they've maintained some sections of. Like, they don't have the ideological armoury to basically come out and say, identity politics, top to bottom, side to side, 100%, is absolute bullshit and needs to be totally defeated. They don't and I think this is largely because they don't see the primacy of class, how this relates to oppression, and the ability of the working class struggle to unify the different oppressed groups in a struggle against the system itself, which creates oppression. And I think this is the reality, is that, like, this is why talks like this are so important, is because there is no halfway house or anything like that between Marxism and identity politics. There's no ability to take a little bit from here and a little bit from there and maybe create this new theory and that'll all be lovely and we don't really need to sort of say that we reject all of them. This is not the case. They are totally contradictory theories. One is about fighting and liberation, and that is Marxism. And the other one, I think, is actually about defeat and coping, which is identity politics. And to overcome the limitations of identity politics, you have to just be that clear. You cannot ameliorate some of its worst elements and its more obvious limitations. You have to junk it as a system of thought entirely. In a reply to Makosha and Petman in the same edition of Hecate, Sandra Bloodworth, a member of Socialist Alternative, pointed out these deficiencies and made the argument that because class oppression is the result of class society, there are not separate struggles against class and oppression. The emphasis on class as fundamental does not blind Marxists to oppression, rather it informs the opportunity to fight it. And I think it's just even more clear now in 2010 that the reality is organising on the basis of identity politics led to an absolute dead end. And again, I think this point is worth stating again and again and again, that this is in fact not surprising. The political development of identity politics is a cogent, or kind of like semi-cogent, or kind of cogent theory. This was always a retreat from the social struggles of the early liberation movements towards a position of mitigating or alleviating some of the worst effects of oppression, an opportunity, again, that working class people who were oppressed did not have the opportunity to enjoy, as we were never able to retreat to the ivory towers that the middle class intellectuals could. And in fact, an early preoccupation of the early liberation movements was in fact not purely to focus upon your own oppression, although that was important, but actually to come to an understanding of the oppression of others so that you could stand in solidarity with their struggle. And this was because, at least in the early 1960s, late 1960s and early 1970s, there was, amongst certain sections of these movements, an understanding that oppression did have a common starting point, and that fighting the oppression of others could only strengthen your own struggle for emancipation. And I have examples of that I wanted to use, but I'm sort of running out of time, so I might leave that to the discussion. And the other reality is that, unlike basically the implication of identity politics, being oppressed on that basis alone doesn't actually make you left-wing. It doesn't mean that you're actually going to take left-wing positions on questions of your own oppression. Just one example out of many, you could see the position of Penny Wong, the lesbian senator for the Labor Party, who refuses to take a stand on same-sex marriage and rather just states time and time again that she agrees with Labor Party policy. It doesn't mean, just because you're oppressed, that you will line up with the demands of the oppressed group. And in fact, believing that everybody who is not part of your identified grouping and that everybody else is pretty much the benefactors of your oppression becomes an absolute political and practical barrier to any solidarity amongst the oppressed being shown. Now, there are many examples of this. Just a couple of them. Feminists supporting the US war machine, invading Afghanistan in the early 2000s due to spurious claims from the likes of Condoleezza Rice that the invasion would liberate Afghan women, or a number of French feminist groups who at the moment have lined up with the French state in the proposed ban on the burqa in France and things like that. But I wanted to highlight a particular example which is relevant, I think, to a lot of the activity that Socialist Alternative does, which is the question of Palestine. And a particular example of, in 2006, World Pride, the big LGBTI world event, was being hosted in the state of Israel, which is a racist apartheid state. And even more insultingly, World Pride was being held in Jerusalem, which is the historic capital of Palestine, which is a divided city with Israel claiming half of the city for its own while it expands illegal settlements into the other half. And this is the situation. 2006 was, of course, also the year when Israel attacked Lebanon. The slogan for World Pride this year was Love Without Borders. Now, in my opinion, something like World Pride being held in Jerusalem or anywhere in Israel is something that should be boycotted and opposed by LGBTI people and everyone else for that matter. But the reality is, if you hold the communalist politics of identity politics, well, on what basis would you oppose such an event? You know, in fact, your politics would most likely draw you to support it because it's a defiant statement of our community against its oppressors. And, of course, the racist element that comes into that, I'm hoping, is quite obvious. When the reality of the situation is totally the opposite to this, where what is happening is that you are supporting an apartheid state in its genocide against the Palestinians, something that the Israeli state itself is quite conscious of because they've time and time again tried to influence things such as queer film festivals and stuff like that to try and maintain an image for itself as being the anti-homophobes in the region. And many LGBTI people who hold identity politics have actually ended up in, reinforcing that sort of propaganda offensive by Israel to sort of defend what it does against the Palestinians, which is an absolute genocide. And to give you a sense of how vile the logic of these politics are, in 2006, James Wilson, who held my equivalent of my position in the National Youth Students in New South Wales in 2004 and 2005, wrote an article for the student newspaper where he tried to justify World Pride being held in Jerusalem, despite the fact that many queer Arabs would be prevented from going because they're not allowed into Israel. And he argued that he'd defend it because Israel has by far a better record than the surrounding countries on queer rights, and that without this, many queer Palestinians and Arabs would not be alive in the first place. So I'm hoping that you see instantly just how vile and disgusting it is. And unlike identity theorists who supported World Pride and who wanted to label all Palestinians as vile, backward homophobes who are responsible for the oppression of gay and lesbian people in that area, I think that, in fact, LGBTI people, the oppressed, have an inherent interest in supporting the fight of the Palestinians in their fight for freedom as part of our own struggle against a vile, fucked-up capitalist system. Because they're fighting against a major plank of that system, of imperialism, and I think that any commonality we can draw from their struggle and ours is actually an important one that we should do. So you may have noticed, just to begin to sum up a little bit, that I've talked a lot about identity politics and critiqued it, and haven't actually talked a huge amount about Marxist theory itself somewhat. So there's a couple of things to say. That contrary to a lot of the allegations that I'm sure comrades here have heard that are quite often thrown against us, Marxists do not denigrate the fight for oppression. We see it as being incredibly important. And we are not opposed to the oppressed formulating their own identity in the context of a struggle against oppression. So, for instance, we welcome historical developments such as the Black Civil Rights Movement in the heat of the struggle against the Jim Crow laws and other things, beginning to formulate their own sort of identity, you're going against all the old racism to declare black is beautiful. Similarly, we welcome the gay liberation movement while challenging the medicalized notion of homosexuality as a disease that you could be lobotomized for, daringly declared that gay is good. But examples of this are not about creating an identity that is utterly distinct and autonomous from that of other oppressed groups. And oppressed groups, including the working class, which I think it's well worth saying, is itself not only exploited, but is actually oppressed under capitalism. Working class, which is also, as well as being oppressed under capitalism, filled with representatives of the oppressed group. Women make up half the working class. LGBTI workers also exist. Surprise, surprise, we are actually out there, despite the caricatures in the gay and lesbian community, such as that of queer as folk, which just represents middle class layers. And the positive identities that were formulated in the heat of the struggle in the early 1970s were formed in struggles that were actually aimed at tearing the capitalist system to pieces, not in accommodating to it, because they actually identified oppression as coming from the very structures of capitalism, with the understanding that it's not only possible, but it is actually necessary for different oppressed groups to stand together in revolutionary struggle, and understood that the capitalists seek to keep us separated at all times with their barriers of fear and hatred, and barriers such as this must be overcome for any group to win its liberation. We understand, as Marxists, that sexism, homophobia, as well as other oppressions are rooted deep into the very dynamics of the system, and that the capitalist class collectively benefit from this situation, including those who are themselves sexually oppressed. And the fight against the capitalist system, against its economic exploitation and the oppression of the working class, is inherently a fight against oppression. Oppression that aims at dividing workers across communalist boundaries so as to undermine this unity which is so necessary to bring the system down. That aims at entrenching dominant forms of social organisation, such as the ideas of a nuclear family, and which is used to reproduce the next generation of the workers to exploit, and to undermine the confidence of workers by making something so fundamental to our being, our sexuality, something which is absolutely alien to ourselves and out of control. And I think that it is only by getting rid of this system, and I echo much of the early liberation movements in saying this, it is only by getting rid of this system and the system of class differences that the material basis for oppression itself will be undermined, which will create the conditions necessary for sexual liberation. And how much time do I have left? A lot of time, 42 good.
42 minutes.
42 minutes. Well, I'll leave that for the summer.
All right. That's it.
Yeah, that's it.